This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, is off this week. Coming up, activists get ready to blow the whistle on abusive police. A civil rights leader burns his NAACP membership card. And a deafening silence from the so-called progressive media on the systemic murder of African Americans. But first, the activist group BAM, by any means necessary, has filed a friend of the court brief in support of a University of Texas admissions plan that has dramatically boosted black and brown enrollment. The 10% plan guarantees admission of the top 10% of graduates of all Texas high schools, from the richest suburb to the poorest inner city classroom. Shanta Driver is an attorney for BAM in Detroit.
When affirmative action was banned in 1996 in Texas because of a decision called the Hopwood decision, in 1998, the Texas State Legislature voted to create a program in which the top 10% of students that graduated from any Texas high school would be guaranteed admission to the University of Texas. They didn't rank the high schools. They didn't look at your test scores. They didn't look at where your high school was located. They didn't look at whether you took AP classes. In other words, all of the common variables that are used in admission system that make it much more difficult for Latino and black and poor white students to gain admissions into their state's flagship universities were not considered in the admission process. And that 10% plan just had an enormous impact on the University of Texas itself, but also on educational opportunity for many, many, many students that had previously never even dreamt of applying to the University of Texas. And it meant that all of a sudden there were literally dozens of high schools that had never sent anyone to the University of Texas that started first slowly, but then it really snowballed to send their top 10% graduates to the University of Texas. And by 2009, about 81% of the admissions at UT Austin were people that entered through the 10% plan. And the university has said that the academic quality of the university has improved, that the students that were in the top 10% of their class, many of whom the university said had test scores that were 200-300 points lower than students from suburban schools, were performing oftentimes at a much higher level and were much more serious students than those that could perform really well on the test, but had not developed the kind of will to learn and love of just intellectual pursuit that students who came from very poor inner city black or Latino high schools or white rural high schools that had to master as a young person in order to graduate at the top 10% of their class. So, in the 10 years that the 10% plan had been in effect, in each year, there was growing controversy and opposition to the plan, largely from students that came from very well-to-do white families from the Dallas and Houston suburbs that claimed that their sons and daughters, who were not in the top 10% of their high school's graduates, ought to have a pathway to admission. And there was a cap placed on the number of students that could get in through the 10% plan, and that cap was 75%. And then there was a special admission track that had always existed but was becoming smaller and smaller and smaller as the popularity of the 10% plan grew. And that special admission track looked at traditional admissions criteria, including, most importantly, test scores and alumni points and you know, whether or not your high school was considered one of the top best high schools in the state. In other words, things that students themselves had no control over. You can't control what family you're born into. You can't control what neighborhood you live in. And so those kinds of criteria have always given unfair advantages to rich white students. Within that special admissions track, there's a tiny, small affirmative action program that has prevented that special admissions track from being something other than just a white privilege track, a form of the new Jim Crow. And that's what's being contested in this case, the legality of that little affirmative action program within the special admissions program. And what we found is that virtually every other liberal group has chosen to defend the use of that small affirmative action program that amounts for about 70 to 100 Latino and Black students being a part of the entering class of the University of Texas by trashing the 10% plan. And the 10% plan has increased the numbers of Latino and Black and poor white students tremendously at UT. A part of the reason why it's never been possible to win a vote in the Texas legislature to overturn the 10% plan is because for the first time in Texas, East Texas rural legislators, and East Texas has traditionally been Texas Klan country, have united with Black and Latino inner city Texas legislators fighting to defend the 10% plan because both their constituencies have benefited from it. And so there's been a kind of class line on in defense of a program that has really served to increase the number of minority students and particularly Latino students, but also the number of poor students of all races.
Yes, it's obviously a class problem here, but how do these other supposedly progressive organizations justify going after the 10% plan?
In ways that are not too disguised, basically they say that upper middle class Black and Latino students should be favored at UT over and against their poorer sisters and brothers, and that the poorer students that have gotten in are not people who do very well on standardized tests when they graduate from the university, and so oftentimes find themselves unable to get into the University of Texas Law School or other, you know, premier law schools or medical schools. And to tell you the truth, that argument is just completely spurious because those law schools and medical schools, since Grutter, can use affirmative action, do use affirmative action. And the University of Texas has published statistics saying that by the point of graduation, the academic gap between the students that have come from the less privileged schools and the more privileged schools is closed, and that those students are just as academically proficient and qualified as any of the students from the richer areas. So it's kind of an argument for elitism, but with no real backing. And the other main argument that is put forward is that the only reason why the 10% plan has led to such a high degree of Black and Latino students entering the University of Texas is because Texas high schools are so segregated. And so that if you go to a school in an inner city school in Dallas or in Houston or in San Antonio, it is likely to be a school that has no or next to no white students in it. And so it, by definition, you're going to be Latino or Black or a mix of the two if you graduate from such a school in the top 10%. And again, in my opinion, the only way to break through the segregation of those inner city schools and to start to create voluntary desegregation programs in those Texas cities is by maintaining the 10% plan. Because in city after city where there's been an advantage to Black and Latino students going to a particular school, it doesn't take long for it to dawn on the white people that they do better to try to institute some measures of integration in K-12 education than simply allow the Black and Latino students to take advantage of something that was unforeseen. For years and years and years, Brooklyn Tech, Bronx Science, those schools were New York schools that are magnet schools, were overwhelmingly Black and Latino schools, and white students did not go to them. When those schools provided a pathway to entry into the top universities of this country, all of a sudden, more white students started going to them and more resources were put in them. And, you know, there was greater integration. But that also meant that those Black and Latino parents were in a position to bargain for the creation of more magnet schools and other programs for their sons and daughters. So in our view, if you want to break down segregation in K-12 education, maintain the top 10% plan, because for most of those wealthy white people, their ambitions for their children is stronger than their prejudices, and they'll find a way to overcome them if it means creating a situation in which there's a pathway for their sons and daughters as well.
Well, isn't that something? Texas is setting an example for the nation. Who'd have thunk?
It is, and I agree with you. It makes me laugh, too, because, you know, Texas is one of those places where for generations, for 100 years, every attempt at stopping the segregation based on racial lines and the race caste system that is Texas, that means that in certain areas, if you're Black, you're considered higher than Latino, and in other areas, if you're Latino, you're higher than Black, and that has just been a very stratified race system that in all places that now we are seeing this breakdown. And I think the other reason that the Texas plan is resented by a number of the so-called liberals is because it's taken the admissions process out of the hands of university administrators, and it's placed it in the hands of state legislators. And that's made clear that really you didn't need this whole elaborate maze of criteria and this elaborate admission system, which no one can make sense of, and instead that you could have a completely transparent admission system based on single criteria, how you do in high school, and that system could be yielding the same or better results than the old traditional system. I think it's taking that power away from the university administrations and putting it in the hands of the people. That also has caused the 10% plan to seem so objectionable.
And everybody at every school, including the most lowly rated inner city schools, has at least a theoretical shot to go to the University of Texas.
That's right. And Texas A&M, after Texas, established a 10% plan. And Texas A&M was super white. And for the first time, it's getting large numbers of Latino and Black students. And, you know, forever until the 10% plan was created, 57 high schools in Texas, suburban, wealthy high schools, accounted for more than 60% of the entering class at the University of Texas and at Texas A&M. I mean, that is a shocking number that in a state that big, that 57 high schools would be the main feeder schools for the University of Texas and for Texas A&M. And now that number has increased tremendously. It's really broadened out educational opportunity. And they've coupled the 10% program with scholarship programs, with programs to provide the kind of support that students coming in from high schools that were pretty crappy high schools would need to be able to compete and overcome the deprivation that they had had in education until the point of the universities. And the students, they've just blossomed. The other thing that makes me laugh is the University of Texas for a long time was a competitive school, but not a highly competitive school. In other words, there weren't a tremendous number of people that wanted to go there. Because of the success of the 10% plan, it's become a much more dynamic campus. Austin is changing. Its Black community is emerging. The music scene that Austin is famous for is becoming much more inclusive of all kinds of world music, and it's a draw now for people from all over the country. It's made that campus so much more dynamic, and you're right, this is a model for the rest of the country. I wish that in our state of Michigan, they had something like this, because I promise you, virtually no Detroit high school has anyone that ever gets to go to the University of Michigan. And under such a plan, our sons and daughters would be able to go. And I'm certain they would shine just as brightly as those students from Dallas and Houston are right now at UT.
And what's the timetable in this legal battle?
October 10th is the hearing at the Supreme Court on the case. I think that will be days one. I think win or lose at the Supreme Court, the operation that is behind the Fisher case, which is what's going to be heard on October 10th, the very, very rich segregationist from Texas that has backed the attack on affirmative action in that state, will bring a suit against the 10% plan. And I think they are going to be claiming that that plan is a plan which does not take individual consideration into account and is just a broad, racially based program, and try to get it struck down. We think that we can really build the new movement to protect that 10% plan, because the students and the communities that have made gains, I don't think they're going to give it up without a fight.
That was Shanta Driver of BAM, By Any Means Necessary, in Detroit. School is about to begin, and in New York City, that's like the beginning of hunting season for the cops, who are on the prowl to stop and frisk Black and brown kids. But as Carl Dix explains, the movement to stop and frisk is getting ready.
Well, our preparations are that we have to go into school and begin right now connecting up with the students while they're out of school to put in their hands a way to take resistance to what the police are doing to people to a higher level. And our approach to that is an initiative that we call blowing the whistle on stop and frisk. You know, when you're going to blow the whistle on something, you're going to put a stop to it. And we're going to do that figuratively, but also literally, because on September 13th, here in New York City, but also we're spreading it to cities across the country to act in solidarity. The afternoon of September 13th, we want young people coming out of school. We want older people coming off of work, folks who ain't got no work to come off of, whether they're young or old, to gather in neighborhoods across the city with their whistles and some cameras, be on the lookout for cops violating people's rights, and when they see something, blow the whistle. Blow the whistle to draw a crowd, but also blow the whistle to indicate that we are no longer going to accept this abuse in silence.
What other cities are you planning to begin this campaign in on the 13th?
Well, we've already made a connection with some folk in San Francisco who have had their own bout with stop and frisk, because the mayor of San Francisco had announced that he was going to bring stop and frisk to San Francisco, and they started a no stop and Frisco movement there. So we're connecting in with them, but we're also spreading it into Los Angeles. We're looking to get it into Chicago and as many other places as we can, because while in New York and Philadelphia and a couple of other cities, they have an official policy of racial profiling that they call stop and frisk, police departments all across the country carry out the same kind of racial profiling. And in every city across the country, it's the pipeline to mass incarceration and the torture-like conditions that they've got so many black and brown people in across this country. We feel like we got to resist this. We have to involve people in beating this back. And we're going to take a big leap with that on September 13th. And then we're not stopping there. That's going to be a new position to leap forward from, because we're going to go forward from there. We're looking in October to go to prisons across the country, saying that the conditions that they have people in those prisons are unacceptable. But even the fact that the society is dealing with its social problems by warehousing our young people in prisons is unacceptable, and that we're going to fight that.
The stop and frisk numbers in New York City are down dramatically. What do you make of that?
Well, what we make of that is that all of the outcry against stop and frisk, the protest actions, the civil disobedience actions that the Stop Mass Incarceration Network engaged in, has actually got the architects of stop and frisk on the defensive. They're offering concessions, talking about mend it but don't end it in relation to stop and frisk. And what we think is that we have to keep on the offensive, because we feel like if we ease up, what Bloomberg, who's the mayor of New York City, Kelly, who's the police chief, are going to want to do, and what they're trying to do right now, is look for partners in cutting a deal that mends stop and frisk, but by which I mean keeps in effect the essence of that policy, which is treating our young people like criminals, but maybe makes a surface reform or tweaks it, or even if they give it a different name. We are not going to stand by silently and let them treat our youth like criminals. This is a part of suppression of a whole people. You know, that's why I raised the phrase mass incarceration plus silence equals genocide, and that it's time to break the silence.
And if it is a violation of constitutional rights, you can't be halfway violated.
Yeah, that's the thing, because, you know, I always tell people when they say, well, the numbers are going down, isn't it getting better, Carl? I say, well, I was around back when we were taking on the old Jim Crow segregation, you know, segregated lunch counters, segregated bathrooms, black people on the back of the bus. And the demand of the movement back then was not give us a few extra seats on the back of the bus or clean up the colored toilets. It was to abolish that category of second-class citizenship. And it's got to be the same thing. If you are fighting injustice, you can't say, give us a little less injustice, because it is still injustice. We have to actually fight to say that this injustice must be stopped. And, you know, we have lively debates and discussions about what it's going to take. I mean, I come from the position that it's going to take revolution to get rid of all these injustices. But then we have our ministers in there of various, you know, Christian, Islamic faiths who are coming from their perspective. But where we come together is that we must stop this injustice. And that's what blowing the whistle on stop and frisk on September 13th is going to be a part of doing.
And you may have to blow the whistle on some of those preachers that the mayor is trying to peel off.
Yes, I mean, preachers and politicians, because what they're doing, and this is, again, not particular to New York City, is they cite crime as the justification for what they do. I mean, the New York Post even went so far as to go into a black neighborhood and find a shooting victim that they could get to say he was in favor of stop and frisk. You know, and I've issued an open letter to the New York Post and to this young brother saying to him, like, look, my heart goes out to you because, you know, you shouldn't have gotten shot. But let's be clear. One, stop and frisk ain't about getting guns off the street or combating crime. It's about suppressing young blacks and Latinos. And two, if you want to get to the heart of what causes crime anyway, it's this system. That's what we need to deal with. So we have to not fall for these justifications, just like in Anaheim when they killed those two young brothers there that people responded to with protest and rebellion. Their justification for that was, oh, well, these people that we shot were gang affiliated, so we're not supposed to care about them being murdered by the police. But as you can see, a lot of people are trying to break through the lies and the justifications they give for what they do to us and saying, we're not going to accept this anymore. That needs to be built on. It needs to be taken to a higher level. And that's what we're doing, because this injustice is unacceptable It's illegitimate, and it's got to be stopped. And anybody that wants to get involved in this, go to our website. That's www.stopmassincarceration.org. That's stopmassincarceration, all one word, .org. And you can see what we're doing around September 13th. You can see what's happening around the trials of the stop and frisk protesters. And you can get connected and spread the opposition to mass incarceration and active opposition, because we're not just talking about opposing mass incarceration. We're acting to fight it and acting to stop some of these injustices.
Carl Dix of Stop Mass Incarceration, speaking from New York City. This past Sunday, Reverend Edward Pinckney, the elected president of the Benton Harbor, Michigan NAACP, publicly burned his membership card in the organization. Reverend Pinckney has led a decade-long fight with the Whirlpool Corporation, which dominates mostly black Benton Harbor. But Pinckney says the state and national NAACP have been on the wrong side of that fight. Plus, they're too greedy.
We want to bring attention to the NAACP, and we want to make them more accountable to our community. We are sick and tired of the NAACP coming in here with a Freedom Fund dinner and then leaving with all the money.
And what about their behavior vis-a-vis your nemesis, the Whirlpool Corporation?
I never thought for a moment that the NAACP would sell out the Whirlpool. And let me tell you the story of how it came about. What happened was Whirlpool and his representative went down and met with the state president of the NAACP, Yvonne White. And Whirlpool told them that they wanted to work with the NAACP, but they would not support the NAACP under Reverend Pinckney leadership. Immediately, right then, they started working, coming up with ideas how to get rid of me. They even made the statement that we had not had a meeting in 6 months, and we have a meeting every month, sometime two.
And how did they go about trying to oust you?
The first thing they did, they went out and they put it, Whirlpool put it on their website, that the NAACP is looking for people who's willing to vote against Reverend Pinckney and they would get a membership. And what they did, they collected 250 memberships. But still, that wouldn't have been enough to defeat me because most of them was there. So they came up with the idea that since I filed a suit against them, that I should not run for president anymore, even though the judge stated that before the NAACP can make a decision, I must file my complaint with Ben Jealous, and Ben Jealous must answer my complaint. Until then, they can do nothing.
But the NAACP continued to move against you anyway.
Absolutely. They continue to move against me, just making all kind of statements that they knew that was not true, and they continue to do the same thing over and over again. If you look on the internet, you'll find there's probably 20 units that they have came in and took them over, and you were unable to complete it. If you don't take them to court right away and stop that election, you'll never stop it.
But you have already burned your NAACP membership card.
Right. I burned it. I said, I don't want to have nothing to do with the NAACP no more. All I want to do is take them to court and make them not just do right for Benton Harbor, but around the country. Too many times we have given them a free pass because they're the NAACP and what they did 40 years ago. Because right now they're just a shell of what they used to be.
Are you hoping to spark a rebellion throughout the NAACP?
Absolutely. What I want to do, I want to start holding them accountable for their action. I am sick and tired of them every time something happens and come in at the end and then want to take over like they've been there at the beginning.
And what's this about the state NAACP giving Whirlpool a corporate award?
They're planning on giving Whirlpool an award for the best corporation in the state of Michigan.
In return for?
For them taking over or financing the hostile takeover of the Benton Harbor branch of the NAACP.
Reverend Edward Pinckney in Benton Harbor, Michigan. Earlier this summer, the Malcolm X grassroots movement released a report detailing the killings of blacks by police, security guards, or white vigilantes from New Year's Day through June 30th. The study found that 120 African Americans were executed without trial, one every 36 hours. Rosa Clemente, the former Green Party vice presidential candidate, was one of the authors of the study, which was largely ignored by even the so-called progressive media.
Unfortunately, these progressive outlets and some mainstream outlets that we may see people that we would think would at least say that the report is out there, whether it's MSNBC or Michael Eric Dyson filling in on the Ed Schultz show, or Reverend Sharpton or Melissa Harris Perry. No, they've chosen to ignore it because there's no way they don't know this report exists. There's no way they don't know, or somebody hasn't brought it to their attention. And we're dealing right now with an electoral political season that really doesn't want to talk about this issue. They don't want to deal with the issue of race or the systematic violence. They don't want President Barack Obama or his Justice Department to be kind of put on blast, as we would say in hip-hop. So they're purposely ignoring it, which to me is more, it's more nefarious than CNN and Anderson Cooper saying they don't want to, because these are folks that will consistently say that the journalism that they're engaging is community journalism and that there's a responsibility. Well, they're not at all being responsible in what they should be doing. I don't know if we necessarily hold them just accountable or if we really need to understand that part of any organizing activist strategy moving forward will have to include now, or we're really going to have to figure out how we are going to begin whatever black or brown kind of independent news network, however that looks, how we're going to create that. I think it's sad, you know, and I think these folks are consistently back in communities of color because they are people of color. I think it's for other, like, progressive outlets like a Democracy Now or The Nation or In These Times or many other places we could cite that they haven't covered this either, or that it's just been a news headline. I think really speaks to about how maybe this is not valued and we're not valued when it comes to telling stories.
Yes, it almost seems as if the only black news that's thought of as newsworthy is the black president.
Yeah, I would 100% agree. And in fact, when a friend tried to get it on MSNBC for me, the response I got was that they were doing nothing but covering the election. And when I got that response, I said, okay, well, I'd love to come on as a former vice presidential candidate and talk about some issues. And they were very clear that they are focusing on the Democratic Party and that they would not be covering anything outside of that purview until maybe after the election. But and as we know, we're looking at a murder every 36 hours of a black woman or child. So how many more of these when the election happens? And why would it be important after the election? It's not important to the president now or some of these journalists. I don't see them seeing it as important after the election is over.
One suspects that there is an active collaboration promulgating the illusion that we are in some kind of post-racial society in which things like this just don't happen.
Yeah, and I think that's just a fact that we can clearly, like, if we all needed to vet it or really research it, it's not a conspiracy. It is what's happening. And then when we even look at what is being talked about from these progressive or left or non-mainstream news outlets, when they do cover this election, it seems that they're all almost in the tank for Obama, no matter what happens, no matter what values he doesn't deal with or what issues he refuses to talk about. This report is critically important to our community, so we can see that they've chosen not to cover really any issues that affect black or Latino communities unless it's a sensational kind of case, a super egregious kind of case. And when they do, we also have to look as journalists or people who engage in media at any level, it's not just when you tell the story the first time, is are you following up 6 months later? And are you telling the new narrative that is coming out of these stories? You know, so just a mere mention or one mere segment, it does not suffice for what needs to be out there for people to understand what is happening, not only with this every 36 hours, but the issues that are critical to black and brown life in the United States of America.
One thing is sure, that these extrajudicial killings will continue after the election. The writers of the report said that they anticipated that there might be an upsurge in racist violence against black folks with the election of a black president, that it would so stir up racists that they would be moved to increased violence. But do we have any data that shows there has been an increase?
I mean, I think we particularly don't flush that out in our report, but I mean, we could look at stories that we've seen. We could maybe take a look at the Southern Poverty Law Center that does a really good job at tracking what they would call hate crime. I believe that there's definitely been an upsurge in racist violence since the election. I could be wrong, and it could just be that we have more access to information and these things are happening at the same level. But I think, and what I know and believe to be true, that there has been an attack against blackness, brownness, since the election of President Barack Obama. And in fact, especially in cases where it's young, white, dissatisfied men, or however they're framed in the media, and they should be framed as terrorists and white supremacists and racists that they are. What we're seeing more that I've noticed after Barack Obama's election is younger kids participating in these more kind of gang group hate crimes, particularly against undocumented people. And I'm wondering if the numbers we're not seeing, because particularly for undocumented people, these stories are not reported or they're hidden or people don't want to talk about what happened to them. And I believe it's going to continue that way. We're dealing with massive unemployment still. We're dealing with massive dissatisfaction from white communities that are thinking it's working class and black and brown people that are the reason they're not faring well in this economy or in this life or what America's supposed to be about and bring to them. And I think it will increase. I can't see it not increasing because we never have an honest conversation about white supremacy in this country as a national conversation. So I don't see how those numbers wouldn't increase, and I don't see how our numbers, as opposed to how we frame the report as every 40 hours and then every 36, I wouldn't be surprised if maybe, unfortunately, next year we have this conversation. It could be very well every 24 hours, and we've just seen two really horrible cases of police killing black men, particularly the Chavis Carter case in Jonesboro, Arkansas, where they literally are trying to make us believe that this young man who was handcuffed in the back of a police car took out an own gun and shot himself. They've recreated the scene to literally, I mean, I guess that, as Malcolm would say, they're trying to hoodwink and bamboozle our people to believe that this young man killed himself when we know exactly what happened.
And yet, because black life and non-white life is so devalued in the United States, what we may be seeing is just a snapshot that actually is similar to what we should have been observing before.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely agree with that. I would think that people reading the report, or those who haven't read the report, and will look at it now because it is that user-friendly, it's very well-researched, we have to understand that we don't know all the stories. This is what we were able to research with a very small group of people, too, scouring websites and looking at police reports. But what about, again, the undocumented worker who might have been jumped on his way home from work or her way home from work that did not report this, that did not share this, that the story has stayed internal and hasn't been part of the public record? You know, I mean, I liken this report to obviously the amazing work that Ida B. Wells Barnett did with the Red Book and documenting lynchings. And that was hard work back then to document them. But even with all the information we have now and all the resources, we know that there are a lot of stories that still have not been told, that still have not been found. And I bet you there's not a state or a municipality in this country that there hasn't been a hate crime against a person of color, and increasingly against undocumented brown folks.
Is there a possibility for the Malcolm X grassroots movement by itself or in collaboration with other groups, making this an ongoing project so that we will have a database?
This will be an ongoing project, and right now the work we're doing is really linking with particularly Latino, Latina communities, right? Because when this report came out, you know, again, our resources are limited as a, we're not a nonprofit. We're a grassroots community organization, and our resources are so limited compared to some organizations that should be doing and documenting this work. But in our, when we say Black, in at this moment means ethnically African American. So we haven't even added the numbers of Latino, Latina, those who see themselves as African descendants in particular to this. And last month alone, we had two shootings in less than 48 hours in Anaheim by the Anaheim, California police, killed two Latino young men within about 36 hours, right? So those numbers, the next time we put out the report, we're going to add those that identify or are identified as Latino, Latina. And with that, I think we could potentially see the doubling of this number, and we will continue to document as many cases. One of the reasons that I think the report is very different than some other reports that we've seen around this is around killings, particularly by police, is that this is also a report that's gendered, right? Often the narrative of police killings has been African-American, Latino, young man, older man shot by the police. But what we're now seeing is an increase in women who are being killed by the police and obviously children. So I think we've opened it up to really show people that this is a serious crisis in our community, that the police that we pay to protect and serve with our tax dollars are not protecting and serving us. They're killing us, and often, 99% of the times, they are not even indicted, and they keep their jobs and they keep their pensions, and in fact, they stay in our communities. And, you know, people really need to think about what it means to see a police officer on the beat that, you know, last week killed one of your homies or one of your grandparents or something like that. They have impunity and they keep getting away with this. And as they continue to keep getting away with it, they will feel emboldened to always do this to us, to shoot first, to kill first, and not even have to answer questions later.
You mentioned Ida B. Wells, the great activist of the turn of the 20th century. And in addition to the seminal work that she did with compilation of lynchings in the United States, she was also an activist with the early NAACP. And one would think that the NAACP, which has chapters in almost every locality in the United States, that this would be a natural for them if they had a mind to do it.
As a member of the NAACP, you know, someone who has supported, you know, the work that they do through my membership for a decade, I'm very disappointed, you know, that they have not even chosen to put the report on their website so that their members can see it. But the NAACP and groups like them and La Raza, you know, I think people really have to realize that these are now organizations for the most part for Black middle-class elite professionals who choose to somehow try to do some work in their community, but that these organizations are not change agents anymore. And in fact, they say they're nonpartisan, but we're pretty clear that they are very partisan on the Democratic side, that they're just not doing what Ida B. Wells or Du Bois were doing or when they were part of these organizations or founding these organizations. I think they've steered away a lot from their mission. And I think it's unfortunate that if these organizations or a very small group of particularly Black middle-class men on TV that set the agenda for the nation about what's important in our communities, these folks don't really even live in our communities and haven't lived in the conditions that some of us are living or seeing every day that our community is going through. So they're a disappointment, but for me, I think it's always important for us as progressives and left folks and independent folks and self-determining folks to look at what we're not doing right. There could be a lot of things we're not doing right, but when we continue to put out this information, research it, get it out there, that at least is a little contribution and should be pushing forward at least an agenda around organizing a movement to stop these extrajudicial killings. That's what I'm hoping will happen. I honestly don't believe anything right now will happen. I think we have been so lulled into this election that the next 80-some days is just going to be about reelecting President Barack Obama. Maybe after the election is over, people will realize we are in exactly the same conditions, if not worse, than we were 40 years ago in some areas in this country, and that it's not going to be the elected politicians that get us out of this mess. It's going to be the people organizing with a good media network and component that at least might alleviate some of this mess from the people in our communities that are dealing with it the worst.
Rosa Clemente of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. The Uhuru Movement, through its All African People's Development and Empowerment Project, holds a conference on self-sufficiency in Washington, D.C. in October. Aisha Fleury explains.
The name of the conference is Empowering African Communities Through African-Led Development. And one of the things that we wanted to focus on was pulling in professionals, students, community activists, and people who are engaged in developing projects within our own communities and pooling those resources together for a number of reasons. We wanted to see how we can collectivize what we've already known and in terms of problem-solving abilities, because obviously a lot of us will be engaged in projects that have already been established in different areas, and see how we can kind of standardize that so that that can happen in other places. We also want to be able to pull from the skills of the people there to not only lay down projects in the United States, but think about how we can expand our knowledge base and our skills base to go to places like Africa or the Caribbean or South America, wherever African people are. So a lot of what's going to be discussed are areas where we know that we are deficient in, or that we don't really have a lot of control in terms of media, economics, healthcare, agriculture. We want to talk about all of these things that we have concerns about.
What kinds of projects do you have going right now, and how do you go about choosing a project?
We have agricultural projects in Houston, Washington, D.C., Oakland, California, and in Africa and Sierra Leone. Agricultural, educational, and a number of other projects we've done in the past, rainwater harvesting, and we want to really expand to do renewable energy. How we choose the projects is based on the need. I mean, all across the African world, the need is great in all of those areas, but one of the main projects that we want to really expand to everywhere is focusing on food and agriculture, because as we know, if we don't have food to sustain ourselves, then that's pretty much our life. And whoever controls your food controls you. And so it's going to be really important that we figure out how to expand agricultural projects. We don't choose per se. We have people or members who come into the organization who realize that there's something that's an issue in their community. If it falls in line with the goals and objectives of AFDEP, that's something that we can take on, whether it's healthcare in the past or currently our focus is on infant and maternal health, but we understand because of environmental issues that have been imposed on African people that our healthcare needs run the gamut. So that would be something that we could take on an international level because it affects us everywhere. We definitely want to expose other Africans to the concept of renewable energy and how we can really be self-sustaining instead of depending on outside sources of our community who have not proven that the interest of African people is top on their priority list.
You're calling what you're doing African-led development. Could you talk about the historical precedents?
We're in a time where the development of Africa and African communities is not in the hands of African people themselves. Of course, there have been conferences that have dealt with Africa, and we have African policymakers and heads of state that are included in these conferences. However, they're not really playing to the interest and the needs of African people on a mass level. And so African-led development has been taken on by us to say that we are Africans ourselves. We don't subscribe to dealing with other folks' problems in terms of accommodating corporate agendas or political agendas. The only agenda that we are concerned with is benefiting the masses of African workers and, in some cases, peasants, who these policies at these conferences speak to don't really address. And so it's important to us that we bring conferences and determinations that are being held on an executive high level back to the people and giving us a say on how we can deal with these issues. We have issues on the continent of Africa where 70% of the so-called sub-Saharan Africa doesn't have electricity, which impacts how they receive information. And even in poor Black communities here in the United States, the access to the internet, access to information that the world receives is not in any kind of way that will allow them to get the correct and accurate information. We have the transfer of Black wealth, whether it's through corporate schemes to get Black farmers in the United States and subsistence farmers in Africa to use some sort of genetically modified seeds that basically indebt farmers more. We have environmental policies and environmental racism that continues to lead to a lot of the health disparities that we have in the African communities, whether it be here, like in the case of Brunswick County, North Carolina, that's fighting a landfill being built in the area, and also in Somalia, where you have toxic dumping off the shores, and yet people who were trying to protect Somalian pirates were in trial in Europe. And then we have to deal with food deserts. I mean, a lot of the things that are not maybe spoken about in theory on international levels have really no practical solutions. And so that's what this conference is dealing with in terms of bringing together African people who are the poor, the low income, the average African who can come together and say, this is what's happening in my community, and I want to be at the forefront of solving these problems, and I want to connect with other Africans in different areas to see what has worked and what hasn't worked.
These projects do cost some money. I'm sure that's part of the agenda for the conference.
Absolutely. Like I said, APDEP is an organization that's not funded by corporations. We are funded by the people. And part of what we do is talk about self-sustainability in terms of economics and figuring out ways that we can use our projects to generate income to support our projects. What's happened in places like Sierra Leone, where we've had a number of projects, is that a lot of them are income generating, meaning that if we have a fishing project, the fish that's being produced is going to pay for it, the boats and the materials that's needed to go back out and collect more fish. In the United States, if we have all of these gardens, it can benefit the community by either creating a situation where we have bulk food buying and collective responsibility in terms of using our money to develop our own gardens that eventually can lead to our own produce stands that can replace the supermarket. When we talk about renewable energy, I mean, if we have a small-scale grid of solar panels in the community, that can replace what we get from replace and generate income if it's really successful to replace what we get now from the electric company. So a lot of what we do is about generating income to sustain ourselves and replacing some of the structures that we are using right now. I want to invite Africans who have an interest in developing projects in their community, engaging in practical, not theoretical, not ideological projects, but actual practical work. And we are calling on Africans who may have some skill or knowledge that they receive from college, but a lot of the Africans that's in our organizations are just regular everyday Africans who say, you know what, I work at a power plant, or I know how to sew, or I have admin skills. And so all of these skills can be used toward practical projects within our community. So the conference is going to be on October 13th and 14th, and it's going to be in Washington, Southeast Washington, D.C., and conference costs $35 for general admission for 2 days. I mean, you're paying $35 for 2 days, and there's $25 for students. This is for everyone. We wanted to make it affordable so that everyone could come. We wanted to make it in a place that has a high population of African people, which is in Southeast D.C., and we wanted to open it up. So visit our website, developmentforafrica.org. Take a look at the details of the conference, what our program is looking like, who our presenters are, housing options, transportation options. We have that all there for everyone to see. There's also opportunities to be a sponsor of this conference and to exhibit or vend there as well. So we're definitely interested in everybody attending, so we feel like we want to be able to network and build and grow and strategize for a practical solution to our problem.
And that's it for this week's Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.